addition to Zoom hearings. Each of you will have 15 minutes to state your case in support of your party's position. And appellant counsel, you get an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. A reminder to please state your name and indicate who you're speaking on behalf of before you begin your argument. With that said, appellant counsel, when you're ready, you certainly can approach.
Good morning. My name is John Lucas. I am the attorney for Carlos Contreras, the appellant in this case. This case brings up questions relating to fundamental basis of a fair trial, and particularly the misuse of the rules regarding experts. What we had here is a gentleman, my client, who was accused of a sex assault in this case. So what occurs is that the accusers testify, he has an opportunity to cross-examine them. However, the state then brings in four additional witnesses to all bring to say again what the complainant witness told them. So now the jury has heard the story five separate times on the theory that these are consistent statements. But then the jury hears it a sixth time on a videotape with anatomical drawings using an interview technique through the Corner House style of interview. Not done by Corner House, done by a police officer, but in that way. So now the jury has heard the witness's story six separate times. And in my client's defense, he is a non-English a speaker. It's not his first language, and he speaks it through an interpreter. So
are you objecting to the volume of evidence? I mean, it
would appear
that, you know, I mean, we don't need to have victim corroboration, but it seems as if you're trying to say to the state you can only call two people.
No, I'm not, but that wasn't raised either in my appeal or at the state. But yes, there is a point in time where a judge can limit the number of people, every single person a person ever talked to. A judge could do that on an analysis of prejudice versus probativeness. But what really happens here is that what's noted is the inconsistencies in the statements, and then a police officer, not a neutral witness, not a person from Corner House, not a child psychologist, gets up and explains away every one of the inconsistencies in the testimony. And that's where we have a problem here. The Corner House technique is to provide a framework to allow a child to tell the story, and then they present that in court. The witness that they called an expert in this case is an expert.
About the police officer.
The police officer is an expert on the Corner House technique. He was trained on that technique, and he has done it many times. He's observed other people. He was brought in to testify not about that. No one asked him any questions about that. It would have been fair for him to come up and critique the officer number one that did the Corner House interview, Officer Jacobson. He could have said this officer followed the protocol, and he could have offered some helpful information on that. Instead, what he was allowed to do was opine about why children do what they do, why they say what they say, why they are inconsistent, why they report delayed reporting, why they continue to report after they've had a Corner House interview. All these things where there's no fundamental reliability in the record in this case. There's no point to that in this evidence.
Did the expert also testify to things that you thought were within the scope of what was his qualifications?
Maybe a little tiny bit, and I'll give you an example, sort of a classic example.
Well, I guess but I'll just follow up, because I was just wondering, and maybe, and I don't know, it doesn't appear to be an issue in brief, but where it strayed from, in your view, what was within the order to permit his testimony, were there objections made at each state, or was it pre-trial already decided, or pre his testimony already decided that he could extend into the areas that you are complaining about?
Yes, that was decided ahead of time. There was a pre-trial discussion about that on the record, and Judge Larson allowed that testimony.
So, for example, a delay in reporting and all
right.
of that.
Right, and why? But why there's a delay in reporting? It's
why?
Almost
yes.
like mind reading or child psychology, way beyond this police officer's expertise. And a classic example would be.
I'm not sure I'm getting this. So are you trying to say the police officer should not have been considered to be an expert? And then, of course, because of that, is testimony not given?
He should not have been considered an expert in child psychology because he's not. He could have been an expert in corner house interviewing techniques.
I get what you're getting at.
That's the difference. And you know, I'll give you an example, and it comes from the Sandberg case that's cited in my brief. It's not unusual for a police officer to come up and say, as they said in Sandberg, I've conducted hundreds of these forensic interviews, and many of them involve delayed reporting. That's an absolute fact. And that is something that the Sandberg court said was okay. So had this officer, Schoberl, had he testified to that, that would have been something from his experience. It is not unusual that I have seen that. But he was up there saying why children delay reporting, why they're inconsistent, why who they report to, all kinds of speculation, and there's no evidence in the record of any specific training for this person. And it just, I don't know how we let that stray. And that's a primary issue in this case. Beyond that, I believe that what happens here is that, yes, the officer is not allowed to opine about the specific credibility of the witnesses. But isn't that effectively what he's doing? He's up there explaining all the circumstances that apply to the testimony of the alleged victims in this case, and isn't that vouching here? We don't have any reason to believe that this...
I think that you made the vouching argument. Did you, in your brief to us? I mean, for example, had he been qualified to testify to the things that you're saying, why a child psychologist, then I guess you would have...
Right, and that's kind of like in the Morales-Mulato case, where they couldn't actually do that opining about credibility.
So are you saying he was, because he was a police officer and because he was testifying this way, that it was suggestive that he was... saying something on behalf of credibility?
Yes, Judge, because that is why we have the rules about experts. Not that they just get up and say anything.
I can't be an expert. I mean, you know, he's been in the field since, I don't know, early 2000s, and he's done all these cases, and he does training. So I don't understand why he can't be an expert. That's within the court call.
Because he's explaining why children do what they do. He doesn't know that. He conducts these interviews.
Doesn't the volume of his training and experience go towards his ability to draw on the life experiences of what he did?
No, absolutely not. He can talk about what his experiences were. But here's a good example. He says, children... these are the reasons children continue to report after they've had the corner house interview. Where's that basis? Where do we know that he's followed up with any victims? Very doubtful that a police officer would do that. How would he know that? Does he follow studies? Has he read studies?
An expert witness is also subject to a credibility determination by the jury. So cross-examination, I assume that kind of stuff came out.
To some degree,
I mean, I know you don't want to ask the question you don't know the answer to, but you know his CV is in. He's got all these hours. He's got all of this, and certainly cross-examine gives you the ability to discredit in part what he's saying, right?
I don't think effectively that was done in this case because I'm telling the court that almost everything he testified to was speculation about the motives and the development of children and child psychology.
Your game to posit that to the jury.
No, I don't think so, not unless you've got where's the foundational reliability that gets it in the first place, Judge? That's the problem, is he doesn't, we have nowhere in this record. He can talk about, I've done all these
cases.
What's
the jury instruction on expert testimony? You give a little more, you still give it that same reasonableness and based on their qualifications. I mean, isn't it something you'd expound on in your summation as to whether or not this guy is all about what he claims to be?
Sure, but that's your problem is the gatekeeping. You know, if the rule didn't say that there has to be foundational reliability before this person even takes the witness stand, then I understand what you're saying.
But make an isolated statement that this is why they do it.
Yeah. How does he know?
Judge Smith already asked us. Was there an objection? Was there an objection in terms of how we look at this on review?
I believe that at the very beginning, on the record, there was an objection made by his counsel to this style of testimony. And I maintain that He still could have gotten up and discussed corner house techniques, interview techniques, and whether the officer did a good job. None of that was ever asked. Instead, what the state wanted was him to come up and opine about all these things. And the state mentions in its brief that he has a bachelor's degree in psychology. He's been a police officer forever. What does that mean? A bachelor's degree doesn't get you any type of certification. A lot of baristas at Starbucks have bachelor's degrees in psychology. So what? He doesn't have that basis. He doesn't read any of the material. It's cited in the Schaefer case. He hasn't read anything. He hasn't had any classes in anything. He just knows how to conduct an interview. And this really does dovetail, I believe, in the helpfulness aspect of it. It seems to me that what we do is we argue that, and he says it even in his testimony, the jurors are going to misunderstand everything about child victims. To me, it seems like we're talking about an extreme attitude of naivete on behalf of jurors. This isn't the 1950s. There is so much information out there. People understand. No defense lawyer stands up in front of a jury and says, here's a model of exactly how every sex assault victim behaves. That would be ludicrous.
If the trial court is a gatekeeper and they decide whether or not he qualified as an expert, our standard of review would be abuse of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does it matter that he was past president of the sex crimes investigation unit or something like that?
Well, no, because all he's doing is investigating things. He's not trained in speculating as to why children do what they do.
Even though he had hundreds of cases that involved them.
Well, sure, but where did he, at one point in time, other than taking statements from them, what did he do? Could he come forward and say, I not only that, but I interviewed them as to why I did these, I did some exploration, I did some studies, I read studies, so I got to the bottom of why children do what they do. There's no foundational reliability in this record at all.
You've raised also the sufficiency of the evidence as to the first child.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that dovetails right in here. In the context of this expert testimony that explains away all these inconsistencies, the jury is left with either guilty or not guilty, and no lessers were given. And they should have been. When you have a witness who says, I don't remember his penis touching my vagina, that's the sworn testimony. That's critical here. And then we have several other statements in which that is never mentioned. And the only time it's ever mentioned is in the corner house style interview done by Judge Jacobson with the use of suggestive anatomical drawings. But then after that, she says she does not remember that happening. That's the difference between, if a jury believed this alleged victim, that's the difference between probation and 144 months in prison. That should have been given. Now, even though this witness says she doesn't remember that happening, counsel for the state reaffirms that it did happen through repeated predicate questioning, saying, well, when his penis touched your vagina, were you in the car, and that type of a thing, reinforcing to the jury that that's what really happened. And even Judge Larson describes the testimony of this witness as, quote, vague as to what happened. So that's why this detail matters so much. And that's why having a witness that explains that away and an expert who's not an expert explaining that all away for the jury, a police officer, not a neutral person, not some professional from a place like Corner House or some university or something, somebody from the Anoka County Police Department or Sheriff's Department, and then we don't have any lessers for them to consider. It's not a fair trial. It's just not. And I would look to this, too. When we talk about giving a lesser offense to the jury, where is the evidence that Mr. Carlos Contreras made a knowing waiver of his right to have lesser included offenses provided? Here again is a man who is his.
I thought he had to request it. It's not a sua sponte thing a judge is going to do.
Well, it can be, yeah. And actually, the case law says that a judge can do that if it's applied. And what we have here is a discussion on the record where the judge somewhat, I get a surprised tone in her voice. You're going, it's all or nothing, huh, counsel? Yep, we're not asking for any lessers. Well, when we have all the case law that's come down in our appellate courts about factual basis and guilty pleas and immigration consequences and enhanceability crimes and waivers of right to testify, all these things in which the court is so concerned that these things come out of the mouth of the defendant, that the defendant waives his right to have those lessers. He never did.
What's our standard of review on this issue? And the subordinate question is there authority for the proposition that it must be personally waived?
I cite that in my brief, some authority for that, Your Honor, because it talks about a knowing waiver.
Right, but does it have to be the defendant waiving personally, as in some other trial?
That
decisions.
Is what I am arguing in my brief.
I'm sorry to go over.
That's fine, but if you want to address that in rebuttal, you certainly could take your time and look through
Your notes. Let's do that.
And I'm also curious on rebuttal. You probably don't know, but did the police officer, I forgot his name, Schrabel?
Something like
that. Was he in civvy clothes or was he wearing a police uniform? I'm just curious. If you don't know, don't waste your time looking there.
Counsel probably knows. I didn't try that case.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Beth Beeman. I'm an assistant Anoka County attorney, and I am here today to represent Respondent State in this matter. Just as a threshold, I can let the court know that Detective Schrobel was dressed in a suit and he was not wearing a uniform. In this case, the first issue is whether or not the district court abused its discretion in finding that Detective Schrobel was qualified to present expert testimony regarding behaviors of child victims of sexual abuse. The state is asking the court to affirm his convictions because Detective Schrobel was more than qualified to provide that expert testimony. There is no requirement that it be solely formal training as a basis for somebody to be able to testify. And I think that if the court reviews Detective Schrobel's curriculum vitae, it establishes that he is more than qualified. He's got a double major in sociology and psychology. He has a master's degree in social work. He's been a detective since 2006 at the time of trial. He had been the special victims coordinator since 2011. He has that ongoing education that's listed regarding the corner house format training. And he indicated, too, he himself had conducted about 500 forensic interviews by the time of trial, and that he had conducted approximately 350 sex abuse investigations. And that does include adult criminal sex conduct cases, but he's got that extensive forensic interviewing experience.
Counsel, I understand, the curriculum vitae that was submitted, et cetera. The argument that I hear appellant making is specifically that the testimony that he gave called for speculation, and that it was as to the reasons why children disclose in the way that they do. Can you speak specifically to that part of his testimony and why, what your position is on that?
Yes, Your Honor, the state believes that he was qualified to explain to a jury why children behave the way they do as far as delayed disclosure, ongoing contact, because of that hands-on experience that he has with victims of sex abuse. Even going back to prior to being a law enforcement officer, again, calling the court's attention to his curriculum vitae, that he worked at the detention center. He was a counselor at another setting. He dealt with kids in Project Curfew. And all of those cases, and it's in his CV and in the offer of proof, he dealt with children who were disclosing abuse. He was a lot of times the initial person that they reported to. And I would just also note that in the offer of proof that the state made, He did indicate that he interacted with abuse victims during the process and after the cases were done. As part of his investigations, he would be talking to other witnesses. He's just got almost 20 years of experience in dealing with victims of child sex abuse and understanding their behavior and what factors contribute to why they behave they do when they are being abused.
When he was proffered as an expert, was there any attempt to lay a foundation to challenge his expertise? Were the complaints that Contreras has right now, as far as like how many children talked about delayed reporting, was there anything like that done?
Your Honor, the goal was to, I guess, try and make it as objective as possible.
So was the objection then just a standing objection as to his expert qualifications?
I believe so. That's the way it seemed to me. There was initially an objection to his overall testimony. We agreed that the state could make that offer of proof to the court in the form of the written letter. And then when it came time and the judge made her ruling, there was still kind of, I object to this overall coming in.
So as a reviewing court, then it appears that everyone agrees that we're permitted to determine different areas of testimony based on that standing objection, as if an objection had been made, not that there was no objection. Does that make sense? Did that question come across the way I meant it to?
Maybe if you could repeat it for me again.
Well, what I'm getting at is there's numerous times Contreras is objecting to the caliber of this expert. For instance, when he talks about delayed reporting, when he talks about behavior of the child, things like that. And if there wasn't an objection each time, are we then permitted to rule on those evidentiary issues or those challenges of whether they were beyond his expertise with a standing objection? Or was the trial peppered with, I object, he doesn't have the expertise. I object, he doesn't have the expertise. Now do you get what I'm getting at?
I do, Your Honor. It was not consistent, I object. It was that standing, I don't think this testimony should come in at all. However, there was not an objection to Detective Shorewell's qualifications. In fact, I believe defense counsel at trial conceded that he was more than qualified to testify about the issues. I think that it was more of a goal to keep him out overall and not to anything specific that he would testify to.
Okay.
And then as far as foundational reliability, the district court implicitly relied on what was set forth in the Schaefer case as far as his training and experience from the courthouse model. But she also specifically noted that courthouse training is nationally recognized as a provider of the most current, up-to-date training concerning child abuse, forensic interviews, and it's sort of a clearinghouse for information, the most up-to-date research about child sexual abuse. And so she made the specific finding that based upon his experience and training, his opinions, as stated in the state's offer of proof, have adequate foundational reliability. So I think she considered all the appropriate factors and did not abuse her discretion in finding that Detective Shorewell's testimony was admissible and helpful to the jury in deciding whether or not the victims in this case were telling the truth. And I'd also just indicate for your honors that it was intentional to not have him review those reports or have intimate knowledge of the case. He was the initial screener as Special Victims Unit, but then handed it off because the state believed that would bring in like the taint of making a credibility assessment. And so the goal was for him to provide objective testimony about his experience doing these investigations and based on his training to educate the jury about, you know, common myths that people have or things that they might not understand about things like why kids continue to have contact with their abusers or why they don't tell. The great example in here happened to be that the victim's mother shut her down when she told about it, and she didn't tell anyone for a long time until she felt comfortable telling that neighbor who took the steps to make sure that she was safe. If there's no other questions on that, I'd like to address the sufficiency of the evidence argument. The evidence in this case was more than sufficient to support a conviction for first-degree criminal sexual conduct. In this case, the victim did testify that she thought his dick touched her vagina, and she did say, I don't really remember right now. That is not the same as saying that it didn't happen. She said she thought she did, but then when you look at it in the context of the substantively admissible evidence in this case, which included the forensic interview that was played for the jury, you can see that there she's specifically saying that his dick touched her vagina. If you watch the video, she's specifically pointing at that area on her body, and she also pointed at that area on the photographs. So that substantively admissible evidence makes it clear that that genital-to-genital contact did happen. And this is not a situation where her testimony at trial negates the admissibility of that. It doesn't, she's not denying that it happened. She did never denied that it happened. She just said, I think his dick touched my vagina. I don't really remember right now. That's, I don't remember is not the same as saying that didn't happen, because the state would have to concede if she got up there and said that didn't happen. Well, then I would be out of luck on prosecuting that count, but that's not what happened. She was available for cross-examination. She did initially in her trial testimony give testimony sufficient to support that conviction. But I think when, in addition, the court looks at all the substantively admissible evidence, it is more than sufficient to support the conviction for first-degree criminal sexual conduct. And then just to touch on the issue of the lesser includeds, there is case law out there that explicitly rejects the contention that the court has any obligation to sua sponte, give lesser includeds when one is...
concerned that you're interfering with trial strategy if defense counsel is saying no lesser included, then you're going, I'm going to include a lesser included.
And that's correct, Your Honor. The case I'm referring to is State versus Montremini, which is 819 Northwest 2nd, 447 at pages 459 to 460. And the argument there was that it was plain error for the court to not sua sponte instruct on a lesser included offense. And that case did reference the cases cited in the appellant's brief, and it explicitly rejected that. It did reference the fact and cite some cases talking about this is trial strategy. You can't...
Okay, I misunderstood. I thought you were saying that the proposition was that it was plain error.
No.
That's what the case was about, addressing whether it was plain error.
Correct. It did say it is not plain error for a court to not sua sponte.
I misheard you. Thank you.
Okay. To not instruct on the lesser included. And it indicated there's no obligation for the court on its own initiative, especially in a situation where the appellant has declined that instruction. But it talks about the fact that this is trial strategy, and you can't Monday morning quarterback it and say, gee, I wish I hadn't done that. And so that contention has been specifically rejected, and there is no support in case law that it has to be an explicit waiver by the defendant. The appellant in this case, through his counsel made the assessment that it was not in the best interest to ask for a lesser included, and the district court had no obligation to give such an instruction. And so the state's position is that Detective Schrober was more than qualified, the evidence was more than sufficient, and there is no error in failing to give a sua sponte, lesser included instruction. So unless the court has more questions, I don't have anything else.
It appears not.
Thank you.
All right. As to that last point, and I'll move backwards on it, I do cite cases that say it is the defendant who knowingly who has the right to waive regarding the giving of lesser included offenses. That's language from Lineweber.
The attorney, you're not disputing. The attorney did say, right. No, we don't want it.
Right, but I'm telling the court that I cite cases that talks about a defendant's knowingly waiving their right.
But
and that includes
the Lineweber. The defendant has to be the one to specifically be questioned about that, such as questioned about the right not to testify.
If I had that, I would have put it in the brief, Judge. But I'm asking this court to do that. I'm asking this court to adopt that. And I base that on so many decisions. If you were in the state courts, and I'm sure, I don't know what everyone's experience is, but I've been in these courthouses for 27 years, and I never, except for the last couple of years, would hear this, where after a lawyer walks his client through a guilty plea and a factual basis, then the judge says, all right, defendant, you tell me in your own words what makes you guilty. Why is that happening? Because this court cared about that. This court said, no, this can't just be the lawyer putting in the facts and the person just, you know, acting like like some puppet nodding their head. And there's that about Padilla, about immigration consequences. We didn't care about that for many years, and now those things have to be on the record. We have to be able to advise people on the record. Now you're dealing with a person where we're talking about the evidence in this case absolutely could have supported a second-degree conviction instead of first-degree. Absolutely, based on a witness that reports it to four different witnesses and never says anything about a penis, says under oath on the stand, I don't really remember that. And then the only thing we have is when anatomical drawings are used. Absolutely, that jury could have found him guilty of a second-degree offense, but that he wasn't even asked about it. And I'm going to ask the court to do this. There's not, at a very minimum, shouldn't a judge ask the lawyer if the lawyer has discussed that with his client?
Well, that's what I was going to
ask. They haven't
ask.
Even asked her. She didn't even ask that.
What is the colloquy that you would envision us demanding? It's one thing to ask for a factual basis because obviously the defendant can say what he did. But if what is it that you expect here? Just that you understand that there might be an available, I mean, do you expect the district court to determine and advise the person that there is an available lesser included that applies to these facts, et cetera? Or is it basically asking them, has your lawyer discussed this with you and you've chosen?
Well, I'm not certain about that. I think both would make sense to me. Have you discussed this with your lawyer? And do you understand it? Do you understand? How can you make a knowing waiver if you don't even understand?
Because we don't even do that with jury instructions as a whole. I mean, the court says, here's the jury instructions, any objection. If you had to ask the defendant every time, did you object to do you understand that jury instruction? Do you object? Blah, 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 credibility, the whole thing. I mean, our trials would be so elongated, they wouldn't make sense, and we would be not, we should go without attorneys because you just want the person to speak for themselves. You're not asserting that there's a constitutional right to, like the right against self-incrimination that should be ferreted out. You're just saying this should be a better practice?
Maybe. Well, I wouldn't ever argue that about all the jury instructions because most of them are standard instructions. But when we're talking about a lesser included, where a person's their life is on the line with these lesser includeds, we actually do ask them about whether they want the instruction on failing to testify, on choosing not to testify.
But that's the right
we do that.
Not to testify, right,
right.
Against self-incrimination. So that's
right.
A little more meat to it than where you're at now.
I don't think anybody's ever really realistically going to argue for any additional, you know, inquiry about every single jury instruction with the defendant. But something like this, particularly when you've got a language barrier, I think that is what we should require. We should require this to be a person, because if the case law says, and it does, that the defendant it has to knowingly waive this, defendant's right, then shouldn't we have a knowing waiver? How do we know we have a knowing waiver if some lawyer who can't even speak to his client in a direct language, how do we know that that actually occurred? Very, very quickly, the legal standard, I do say it in my brief about that. Finally, going back to Schaefer, which again, the state supplied that to Judge Larson. Judge Larson read it. Schaefer had a much more detailed record made where they actually took testimony from this officer, and he admitted that he hadn't read any of the research articles that formed the basis of the Corner House Protocol. He couldn't cite any article, studies, or theories underlying his testimony about adolescent sexual abuse victim psychology. He claimed that that there was some research listed in a Corner House training, but agreed that he had never read any of those articles. Nor did the state offer any other evidence, such as testimony from other witnesses or peer-reviewed studies regarding theories or methodologies underlying this supposed expert testimony. That's why, again, he could have talked about the why they do what they do with corner house interviewing techniques,
so
but
noted.
Your time has expired. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. The matters are submitted. And